Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September 12th, 1995. In the fireside room this evening, we will be listening to Susan Blaine, storyteller. Let's listen in.
I would like to share some stories with you that come from all over the world. And then when I'm through with my part, I would like to open it up for what is called in the trade open mic. It's an opportunity for any of you who have a story, 5-10 minutes, to share with the rest of us. So keep that in mind, and if you are so inclined, please do. The first story I'd like to share with you is a literary tale. It comes from a book published by an author named Eugene Coco, and the title of it is The Wishing Well. A long time ago, there was an old man who lived by himself. And when he was hungry, he would go out to a wishing well that was near where he stayed and call down, "Wishing well, give me something to eat." And a basket would appear filled with oats and milk and honey. It would be a fine breakfast. And he would thank the well and turn around and be on his way. Now, he would do that every day, and no one else knew about this wishing well until one day, when he was at the well, a young boy happened to overhear. And he watched, and he listened, and he saw what happened. "Wishing well, give me something to eat." And the basket appeared with oats and milk and honey. And the young boy saw, and he was amazed, and he thought, "I wonder if I could make that work for me." So when the old man had disappeared off with his food, the young boy thought about it and thought, "Well, maybe tomorrow I'll give it a try." The wishing well provided everything the man needed. When it was cold and wintry, he would go to the well and say, "Wishing well, I'm cold. Give me some place to stay." And out of the earth would rise up a cabin, a warm and safe place for him to spend the winter. And when it was summertime and his throat was dry and the land was parched with drought, he would wish for water. And then the clouds would move in and the rain would come down and he could hear it on the top of his hat and it would gather on the brim and run down the back of his neck and he would drink that water in. And in autumn, when he felt the chill in the air, he would go and wish for a new pair of boots or a warm jacket. And whatever he needed, the well would provide. This young boy, he watched and he saw. The well gave him oats and milk and honey every day. And he began to think, "I bet that would work for me if I just tried it." So he waited till the man had left that day, and he went up to the well, and he said, "Do for me what you do for the old man. I'm going to wish for more than oats and honey. I want to be the richest man in all the world." And as soon as he said that, gold coins started to fall out of the sky, and they landed on his head and on the ground. Hoo-wee! He was going to be rich. And he started picking up the coins and filling up his pockets. His pockets were bulging. And then he realized he'd never get all those coins home. "Wishing well, I need a way to get all these coins home." And behind him, there was a creak and a groan, and there appeared a huge wooden wheelbarrow. And he worked all morning to get all those coins in the wheelbarrow. And then, try as he might, he couldn't even lift that thing and move it. He was getting frustrated, and in a panic, he said, "Oh, I wish those gold coins and that old wheelbarrow were, and everything I see would fit in the palm of my hand." And as soon as he did, he started to grow bigger and bigger and bigger. His head went above the mountains and above the trees, and he was up into the clouds. And he kept growing and growing until everything was so small. He went beyond the clouds. He was up towards the moon and the stars. And all of a sudden, a comet went flying by, went right through his hair and caught his hair ablaze. It was a blaze of red and orange. He was in such a panic. He said, "Oh, I wish that none of this had ever happened." The next morning, the old man went to the well for his breakfast. And as he walked up towards the well, he noticed this young man leaning against the well with bright orange hair. And he was weeping. The old man walked up to the well and looked at the young man closer, and the young man looked up at him. He didn't like that knowing look on the old man's face. And he said, "Old man, why are you looking at me? What do you know about wishes? All you ever wish for are oats and milk and honey. Don't you have any dreams? You don't know what this wishing well can do." "Oh, is that so?" And he took off his cap, and underneath his cap was a shock of blaze orange hair. There's plenty of seats over here. The next story I'd like to share with you comes from Bosnia. A friend of mine had a Bosnian grandmother who told him stories when he was little. And out of the tales that she told him, he crafted this story. Once there were two angels having an argument. One of them said, "There are no good people left in this world." "What do you mean?" said the other. "I know there are good and kind people left somewhere." "Oh, no, no, no. I don't believe there are any good, kind people. People who remember God's poor." "Oh, no, I differ with you." So they made a wager. And the angel who believed that there were good people went down to earth to try and find some. And he came upon a village where lived three brothers. Now their parents had died and left them a little house, a little plot of land, and their most prized possession, a beautiful pear tree that stood in the center of the town. Each day, one of the brothers would go to guard the pear tree, and the other two would go off to work in the fields, and they would take turns. So the angel, disguising himself as a beggar, walked up to the brother guarding the pear tree. He walked up and said, "Oh, please, kind sir, I am hungry. Could you but spare me a pear from your pear tree?" And the brother looked and said, "Oh, well, I would, sir, but the pear tree is not just mine. You see, it belongs to my brothers, too, so I can't really give it away, but you can have the pear I was going to eat for lunch." "Oh, thank you, sir." And the angel went away. And the next day, when it was a different brother guarding the pear tree, the angel, once again disguised as a beggar, came up and said, "Oh, please, kind sir, could I have a pear from your pear tree? I haven't eaten all day." "Well, sir, I'd be glad to share my pears with you, but they're not just mine. They belong to my brothers, too, so you can have the one I was having for lunch." Well, the angel was very pleased, and he took it and went away. And then the third day in a row, he showed up, again dressed up as a beggar, and the youngest brother was there, guarding the pear tree. "Please, kind sir, could I have but a pear from your pear tree? I am very hungry." "Oh, well, I'd love to share with you, but you see, the pear tree belongs to my brothers and me, and I'll give you my pear." Well, the angel was overjoyed. He had found not one, but three kind-hearted men who remembered God's poor. So he went back up to heaven and reported to the other angel, and the other angel was a little bit pleased. And then the first angel thought, well, these are kind-hearted people, and I want to do something to reward them. So he went back down to earth. And he went to their door of their cabin before they had gone off to the fields and to guard the pear tree. Only this time he was not dressed as a beggar. He was dressed as a rich merchant. And he went up and knocked on the door, and the door swung open, and he said, I have come to give the three of you gifts. You can trust me. I want you to come with me. Don't worry. The pear tree will be safe. And he took the three of them into a beautiful meadow. It was lush and green, and there was a river going down by the meadow. And he looked at the oldest son and said, look at all of this and tell me your best wish. You mean if I could have anything? Yes, your very best wish. What would it be? Well, the oldest son looked at that meadow and looked at the river, and he thought, I would have grapevines planted here, a whole orchard of grapevines, and there would be barges going up and down the river carrying my wine to market, and there'd be servants coming this way and that way, and they would bow and call me master. That's your best wish, is it? Yes. Very well, then. It shall be. And he struck the earth with his staff, and an orchard appeared, and barges appeared on the rivers, and there were servants going this way and that, and they bowed to him and called him master. And the angel said, all this is yours for your kindness, but remember God's poor. Then he took the two remaining brothers, and they went up higher into a pasture. And he showed the second brother this beautiful pasture that was filled with blackbirds. And he said, what is your best wish? And the second brother looked. I would turn all those blackbirds into sheep. I'd have a huge flock of sheep, and then I would have a mill here by the stream, and we would spin the wool into yarn, and we would make blankets and coats and sweaters, and then we'd ship them downstream. That's my best wish. Very well. He struck the earth, and it was done. There was a mill there, and there were sheep, and there were servants going back and forth, calling him master as well. And the angel said, all this is yours for as long as you live, but remember God's poor. Then the angel took the youngest brother, took him to a high mountain pasture, and there were peaks with snow, and there were lush wild flowers, and he said, now, what do you see here? What is your best wish? Well, the young man looked at the mountain, and looked in the meadow, and said, my best wish, I would have someone love me for who I am. The angel looked at him and said, I wasn't prepared for that. Love you for who you are, Yes, for truly that is the only thing that is really important. Well, now let's see. There are only three women alive right now who will love you for who you truly are, and two of these are married. There's one left, and she's a princess. And there are suitors at the door, so we best hurry up. So he grabbed the young man, and they went traveling very fast to a castle of a king. And he banged on the door, and he was shown in, and he took the young man up to the king, and he said, sir, we have a suitor here for your daughter. What, another one? We've already got suitors here at the gate, and they're fighting over her. How am I going to decide between all these suitors? And the angel said, oh, well, I have an idea. Right, said the king. What is it? He said, I tell you what. Outside, I see some olive trees. Have your gardener cut out three stakes from the olive tree, and we'll put all three of them in the ground, and we'll put the name of each suitor on top of it, and whichever one blooms tomorrow, that will be the suitor that is worthy of your daughter. Well, the king liked the idea, so that's what he had the gardener do. And they put the stakes right here, and the angel tied on the name of the youngest son and then the other two suitors, and they waited. And the next morning, Why, the other two suitors, this one was blooming. Right, said the king, that's the one who will marry my daughter. Well, the wedding was held. There was great rejoicing. And as a wedding present, the angel showed them to a very modest hut that was up in the high pasture. This is yours now, he said to the youngest. This is yours, this woman who loves you for who you are. Now remember, God's poor. And then he disappeared. And up in heaven, a while later, the two angels were talking and thinking about how they were doing. And the angel thought, I think I'll take a little trip down and check on these three young brothers and just see how they're doing. So once again, he disguised himself as a beggar. And he went up to the first brother's house, who by now had all the trappings of a wealthy man. He had a huge mansion and many horses and many gates and many servants. And the beggar made his way through it all and went up to the door, and he pounded on the door, and the door swung open, and he said, please, kind sir, a bit of wine for my throat. I am very thirsty. And the first brother said, away with you, beggar. I don't have your kind at my door. Get out of my yard before I stick my dogs on you. And the angel looked at that first brother. And he said, you have forgotten God's poor. And he struck the earth with his staff. And all of the winery disappeared. It was once again a meadow with a river. Go back to your pear tree. He then went to the second brother's house. He too had been very successful in the wool business, and he once again disguised himself as a beggar, and he went up to the door and he rapped on the door and waited. And when the second brother swung open the heavy door, please, kind sir, a bit of wool for my shoulders. I am very cold and I have nothing to buy, no money. Please? And the second brother said, go away with you, you beggar. I have no free things to give away. Go on, be off with you, be off with you. And the angel looked at that second brother. And he struck the earth with his staff. And all the sheep turned back into blackbirds. And the mill disappeared. And he said, go back to your pear tree, for you have forgotten God's poor. And then he went to the cabin of the third, the youngest brother. It was a modest place, and he went up and rapped on the little door, and his wife answered and said yes, and he says, oh, please, I'm very hungry and cold. Could you but show me a little hospitality? Why, of course, she said, come in. We don't have much, but what is ours we will share. Sit you down here. And she wrapped a shawl around his cold shoulders. We don't have much to eat, just a little bit of soup. I'll be glad to share with you. And she went to ladle out the thin soup that had been made from boiled up roots. And when she ladled it out, it turned into a thick, rich meat stock with lots of vegetables. And the wife and the youngest son were amazed. Well, we have some bread to share with you. It is not much. We make it from the bark of trees, but you are welcome. And when she broke the bread open to share, it became a soft white loaf. And they were amazed. And they looked at the angel, and he smiled up at them, and he said, you have not forgotten God's poor. Come with me. And he took them by the hand and led them out through the door, out into the meadow, where he gestured up, and they looked up, and up on the top of the hill stood a mansion. And on either side of the mansion was row after row after row of pear trees. And he said, this is all yours, for you have not forgotten God's poor. And so they lived there, as they should, being kind to one another and kind to God's poor. And their descendants live there to this day. And that is all. tell something I hadn't planned to, just because it feels right. And I believe in moving with those moments, you know. This was a story that I heard just this past weekend. Haven't had time to rehearse or polish it, but it's just so good, I've got to tell it. I was told by a teller named Johnny Moses, who is a multilingual Native American teller. And he collects Catholic and Protestant joke stories. And this is one of those. And since I was raised in the Roman Catholic tradition, I feel I can tell this story. Once there were two devout Lutherans who had a good long life, and then all of a sudden, tragically, they both had heart attacks and died. And they went to heaven. At least they thought it was heaven. When they woke up and looked around, they said, "Oh, you made it too. Good, we're in this together, okay." And they looked around, and there were some beautiful women and some very handsome men. And they all looked pretty happy, and they were kind of floating around without any feet, just kind of floating, and they thought, "This must be heaven. Yeah, well, let's see if we can get what we want." So they thought about something they wanted, and it appeared. This has got to be heaven. Yes, yes. So they were quite happy. Well, a few days went by, and then they heard a noise. It was a strange screeching, scraping, scratching noise, and then they looked down and they saw some cloven feet. And they looked up and there were the legs of a beast, and they looked up further and there was a creature with a long pointed beard and two pointed horns, and they thought, "Oh no, that's got to be, you know, who? Excuse me, who are you?" "Well, who do you think? Of course I'm who you think. But what are you doing here? We thought this was heaven, and we know that you only live in hell." "Well, where did you get your idea of hell anyway?" "Well, you know, from growing up, all the stories we heard about hell, it wasn't a very nice place, and those people on earth don't know anything about what hell is like." "Yeah, you're in hell, and this is it." "Oh, but it's so nice and pleasant, and it just doesn't fit any description we've ever heard." "Well, this is it, so just enjoy yourselves. And by the way, there is a place way over there. It's like a bit of a volcano. You don't belong over there, so don't go over there." "Oh, okay." So the devil turned, and of course, in a little while, they got kind of bored, and they were real curious about that. And like most of us humans, they did what they were told not to do, and they went over and climbed up this volcano. And when they got up to the very tip, they peered over, and there was a lake of fire. And there were people screaming and yelling and gnashing their teeth, and there were all these little imps poking them with pitchforks. And oh no. And they went back down the volcano and thought, "That's what we thought hell was going to be. Yeah. I wonder if that's where we're going to go. I don't know. Maybe we better talk to the devil." Okay. So they went over and talked to the devil again and said, "Excuse me, sir. What, you again? You just got here. You have questions again?" "Well, yes. We did what we were told not to do. We went up to the volcano and peeked over and saw this lake of molten fire with people being poked with pitchforks. And we wondered if that's what was going to happen to us." "Of course not. That's for the Catholics. They demanded it." All right. This next story I'd like to share with you is an Irish story. I am Scotch Irish, French, German, but mostly Scotch Irish. And I have some very good friends who are wonderful Irish musicians. So this story is near and dear to my heart. "Now, once upon a time, there was a famous Irish piper. He was well known from the tip of the island to the end of the island, from this side to that side. Everyone knew him. He was so good. He had tunes that could make you laugh. He had tunes that could make you cry. He had tunes that lifted your heart or crushed your stomach. He had tunes that would make you feel all different kinds of feelings. His name was Maurice. Maurice was also known for having a tune that would make you dance. Now, I don't mean just a nice old dancing tune. This tune, when he played it, you had no choice. You had to get up and you had to dance as long as the music was played. So, of course, he didn't play it very often. Now, Maurice was blind, God bless him, and his old saintly mother used to lead him around. Now, there was a day when there was going to be a big party on Trafska Beach. It was a lovely white stretch of sand just below the cliffs, and the little waves would go in lap, lap, lap. And early in the morning, the people started arriving with their picnic baskets full of good food, and Maurice and his mother were walking along the sand, and she was guiding him and took him out to a nice rock where he could sit. And the beach was all washed smooth, just fine for some good reels and jigs. And so Maurice started to play. And he played some jigs and he played some reels, and the people danced up the beach, and then they danced down the beach, and then they danced up the beach, until Maurice was a bit puckered out. "Well, I'm a bit tired now. I think we should stop for lunch." So they did. They had their lunch, and he thought, "Well, I'll play one more tune before I go." So he started to play again, and they danced up the beach, and then they danced down the beach, and the sun was beating down on them, and all the grandmothers were sitting over on one side watching the young people. It was a fine party. And Maurice got tired. He says, "Well, that's it. I've had it." They said, "Oh, no, Maurice, you can't quit now. We're just going now. Come on, Maurice, one more song." Well, all right, so he puckered up and played one more song, and they danced up the beach and down the beach, and when it was over, they all clapped and cheered, and he says, "Yes, I'm ready to go." And they said, "Oh, no, come on, Maurice, one more song, please, please, Maurice." He says, "I'm really tired." "Oh, come on, Maurice, please." "Well, all right, I'll play one more song." So he played another song. And they went up the beach and down the beach, and when it was all over, Maurice was really tired. And they said, "Oh, come on, Maurice, come on, play one more song." And they badgered him until Maurice got mad. "You want to dance, do you? Do you want to dance? All right, then. All right, then, I'll see to it." And he put the pipe to his lips and he began to play the magical tune. And as soon as the melody floated out, all the dancers started dancing, but all the grandmothers had to get up and dance too, and the wee little ones. No one could sit when the magical tune was played. And they were all dancing up and down, and they were starting to call out, "Maurice, stop!" But would he stop? No, of course not. He played on. And pretty soon, the most strange thing happened. Out of the waves came the fishes. The codfish came out, and the hake, and the herring, and pretty soon the fishes were dancing up and down with the people. And then the oysters and the lobsters, and they were spinning around on one claw, and the scallops came up, and the crabs, and then the sharks. They came out of the waves, dancing on their tails, going up and down, the whole mob of them, just one after the other. And Maurice was playing and playing and playing, and then the most amazing thing, out from the waves came a beautiful mermaid. Now everyone could see except Maurice, God love him, he didn't know. And all of a sudden the mermaid just came dancing right up, and oh, she was a pretty thing. Her skin was pearly white, and she had a little cap on her jaunty head, and her hair hung down, and she was very lovely, let me tell you. And she walked up in her tail and went right up to Maurice and sang out to him, "I am a lady of honor who lives in the sea. Come down, Maurice Connor, be married to me. Silver plate and gold dishes you shall have and shall be the king of the fishes if you marry to me. Well, Maurice heard this voice and he was really taken and he thought, that's quite a proposition. Meanwhile, he's still playing and everyone's dancing and the sharks are dancing, and so he sings back to her. I'm obliged to you, madam, off a gold dish or plate. If a king and I had 'em, I'd dine in great state. With your own father's daughter, I'd be sure to agree. But to drink the salt water would not do for me. Oh, and the fact that he could play his pipe and sing the song at the same time only attests to his great powers. Well, Maurice, you're a singer too, are you? And is it the salt water you're afraid of? Well, let me tell you, Maurice, I have a magic cap just like my own. I can put it on your head and you'll be able to breathe under the water just as well as you do on land. Oh, come on, Maurice, be my husband and come with me. Maurice, I'll get you back your sight. My sight? How could you do that? Oh, I have potions under the sea. I could restore your sight and you'd be a king. Well now, Maurice, he could be a king, married to a beautiful mermaid, and get his sight back. It was just too much. All right, I'll do it. Meanwhile, old Mrs. Connor had seen this lovely mermaid coming up to her Maurice and talking pretty to him. And then she'd heard what was going on, and she danced her old legs over to Maurice and said, "Oh, where are you going, son? You can't leave me, your old mother who's taken care of you all these years." "Oh, mother," he said, "I'm just going down to be a king, and I'll get my sight back. Please, mother, I'm going to go, and I'll send you a sign that I'm well." "But what would that be?" "I'll send you a piece of driftwood," he said. "Every year on this day." "Oh, no, I don't want you to go. No, Maurice." And then coming from way out in the ocean, a huge wave coming up towards the beach it was. Now all the people could see it and they started to dance away, but Maurice did not see it. And the mermaid had her arm around Maurice and was gently leading him towards the sea where the wave was coming. And his mother saw the wave and said, "Oh, where are you going, Maurice? Oh, off with that unnatural creature. No, and who's to say? You might have children and I might be eating my own grandchildren someday." With a little bit of butter. "No, Maurice, don't go." Well, Maurice was carried into the sea by the mermaid, and that huge wave crashed over his head just as she put the cap on him. And when the wave crashed forward, it caught up all the dancers and the shark and the lobsters and the scallops and the hake and the herring and rolled them one over top of the other. And then when the water went back, all the fishes were gone, and Maurice and the mermaid. And the dancers lay there. They were exhausted. I mean, if there'd been any leather on their shoes to start with, it was a memory by now. They picked themselves up and their tattered bits of shoes and found their lunch baskets and took old Mrs. Connor and went back up into town. A year from that day, Mrs. Connor went down to the beach, and sure enough, there was a piece of driftwood. It was different from all the others. It was a bit burnt around the edges. And she just knew it was from her Maurice. Well, can't begrudge him his sight and to be wed to be a king. So she put the driftwood on her mantelpiece. And over the years, she had many pieces of driftwood piled on her mantelpiece. Now, that's been about 100 years, they say, since Maurice disappeared. But the fishermen who go out fishing in Trafska Bay, they say sometimes they think they can hear Maurice's pipe playing. Or sometimes they'll hear a voice singing, "Beautiful shore, with thy wedded strand, thy crystal waters and diamond sand. Never would I have parted from thee, but for the sake of my own fair lady.
I think we have some dancers in this crowd. All right,
change of pace, change of country. We'll go to China. And this is a story that there are versions in China and there are versions from Mongolia. And it's called The Wooden Bowl. Once there was an old man whose wife had died. And so he moved in with his son and his daughter-in-law. Now he was getting on in years, and when he would sit at the dinner table and eat, sometimes he would lose a little food out one side of his mouth, and there'd be a stain on his shirt. And after dinner, the daughter-in-law would talk to her husband and say, "Why don't you say something? I mean, he's your father." Well, the son didn't know what to say. He said that he's just old, that's all. It's okay. Well, the months went on, and pretty soon the old man began to drool a lot. And so besides food coming down, there was drooling. He always had a wet spot. And the daughter-in-law said, "I can't stand this at the table anymore. I'm sorry. You say something to him. He's your father." Well, the son didn't know what to say. The months went on, and now it was a number of years, and the old man had grown very shaky. And so when they were eating out of a porcelain bowl one day, he was getting the food to his mouth, and his grip loosened, and he dropped the bowl on the floor, and it broke in 1,000 pieces. This porcelain bowl was one of the favorites of the daughter-in-law. So she went to her husband and said, "You've got to do something. He can't sit at the table with us anymore. He's setting too bad an example for the children. He's breaking up my best dishes. I just can't do this. You've got to do something. He's your father." So the son spoke to his father and decided that they would move him from the table to the kitchen table. And then the son went to work. He was a carver for a hobby, and he carved out a wooden bowl. And he gave that to his father to use. So while the family sat in the dining room and ate off the porcelain, the old man sat alone in the kitchen, eating out of a wooden bowl. And one afternoon, the mother and father came home and found their oldest son busy carving. And he said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm carving a wooden bowl for you and mother." Yes, it does. All right. This next story is a gathering of many small stories that I heard over several years. And it's a personal story. It starts with a poem that is not mine, that was written by a man in Arkansas State Prison. Six human beings by happenstance were trapped in the bitter dark cold. Each held in their hands a piece of wood, or so the story goes. Now the dying fire was in need of wood, but a woman held hers back, for as she gazed at the faces round the fire, she noticed one was black. A second man searched that gathering and found no one from his church. So he could not bring himself to give the fire his piece of birch. A third man sat in ragged clothes and gave his coat a hitch. Why, he thought, should I give my log to warm the idle rich? The rich man sat thinking of his money and how he wanted more. So he decided to keep his log rather than share free warmth with the poor. The black man's face was full of revenge as the fire was fading from sight. He kept his log to punish them all, the rich, the poor, the white. The last man of this forlorn group did nothing except for gain. He gave to those who gave to him. That's how he played the game. So the logs were found in death-still hands as a testament to human sin. They did not die from the cold without. They died from the cold within.
Wow.
The year was 1976, and Kenny was 17. He let his hair grow, he'd started smoking dope, he'd moved out from his parents' home, he dropped out of school, and his parents were very worried about him. He'd taken up with bad companions. And on this hot Oklahoma morning, he was with three other men who had all done some time in the local pen. Kenny had never been arrested, not even for a traffic violation. But he liked to hang around with these other guys. Well, one of them put some PCP in with the marijuana, rolled it up, and they were flying. He was gone. And they started talking about knocking over the 7-Eleven a few blocks away. Yeah, it'd be easy to do. Come on, Kenny, come along. All right. He was a follower. Here, they said, you hold the gun. And so when they got to that store, Kenny was told to shoot and kill the owner. And he did as he was told. But he didn't kill him the first time. He had to go back and shoot him again to make sure he was dead so that he couldn't identify them. And they stole $103. And then they scattered. And by nightfall, every one of them was in police custody. Now, the police knew that Kenny was a lightweight for what was going on, and they knew the records of these other three. So they said, look, Kenny, if you'll turn state's evidence and help us with this, we'll see to it that you get out in 10 years. Well, Kenny thought a while, and then he talked to his attorney again, and then he said, how much are my mom and dad paying you? And when the attorney told him what his fee was, Kenny said, you're fired. And then the guilt set in. Why should I turn state's evidence against those guys? I'm the one who pulled the trigger. I killed this guy. I deserve to be punished. And so he went without turning state's evidence, and he pled guilty. He turned 18 during the trial. And when he left the Oklahoma City Jail, he was bound for McAllister State Prison with a signed death warrant. He was going to be killed for this murder. He showed up at the walls, what they call McAllister Pen. It was built in 1911 with prison labor. The walls are 13 feet thick. And he went to death row. When you arrive at the prison, you're strip searched. You're given blue denim pants and blue denim shirt. And then, to go from the entry of the prison up to death row, you are shackled. and there's a belly chain that wraps around your belly, and then it goes down to the feet, and your ankles are shackled, and you're led through the prison like that. And no one is allowed near death row prisoners. Death row, come out! The guards would yell that, everybody would scatter. And Kenny was led through the prison with the sound of his chains dragging on that linoleum floor. Death row cells were individual cells, 4 foot 7 inches wide by 7 foot something long, and the ceilings were short. They were made of metal, 3 sides solid metal with a latrine, with a bunk, and the door was bars that had sliding mechanisms in and out that were controlled by the guards. They were 2 tiers, they were like cages. And Kenny was in death row. 3 days after he was there, he was raped by 3 men. He learned to guard himself as well as he could. You don't stare anybody in the eye, because that's a confrontation, that's a dare. You keep your eyes down, but you watch all the time. So he developed wolf-like movements to his eyes, where he was always checking his peripheral vision, always looking behind him. He learned to have a partner, another prisoner who would watch his back, and he watched his partner's back, because prison is not a safe place. The people there, the men there, most of them were mentally ill, crazy, angry, dangerous, unpredictable men. One day, Kenny was going for lunch, and his partner was on his back, and they were going down the lunch line. It was a line of men dressed in blue, when all of a sudden, 3 guys came up on either side, and they grabbed the arms of the man just in front of him and shoved a shiv right in this guy's ribs, lifted him out of the line, laid him behind a counter, and got back in line. The whole thing took less than 20 seconds. And the guards didn't discover that body till later the afternoon. And Kenny's heart closed. This was not a safe place. He developed a prison of his own that had nothing to do with the bars. It was a cold within side, but it was the only safe place he could go. There was a man on death row who loved to play his radio really loud. And it was really loud, and the other prisoners say, "Turn that thing down!" He wouldn't turn it down, he'd crank it up again. You don't have much power on death row except how loud you can turn up your radio. So these 3 guys were really angry at this guy for playing his radio so loud. And one day, Kenny was in his cell when all of a sudden the door slammed open. And he knew right away, this is not the time when the doors slam open. There's something wrong here. And then 3 men went by the door and went into the cell of that man who played his radio so loud. And he started hearing that man yelling. The next door neighbor to Kenny poked his head around and said, "I think they're hurting him. I'm going to go down there and help him." And Kenny said, "Don't you do that. You stay in your cell." And the 3 men went by the door, went back in their cells. The door closed. And they'd gone down and killed him for playing his radio too loud. And Kenny's heart turned again, tighter and colder. Kenny was allowed a visitor once a week. His mama would come. She'd go into the prison and she'd be patted down, and then she'd be led by a guard down a long hallway and through a corridor, and then around through a number of corridors till she got to the visiting room, where she would get to sit in a chair, and there was a counter, and there was glass, and then there was Kenny, and they had telephones to talk to each other. When Kenny would go to visit his mother, he had to leave death row. "Death row, coming up!" Things would put on his ankles, on his wrists, his belly chain wrapped around, and he'd drag his chains across
the rotunda and go into the hallway and follow the guard down to the visiting room. One time when he was doing that, listening absentmindedly to the sound of that metal on the linoleum, he heard a new sound. It was the sound of his mother's footsteps coming down a hallway. And he slowed down and he watched, and sure enough, right up where his hallway was going, there was an intersecting hallway, and his mother walked right by him. Maybe, he thought, if I walk a little faster next week, I could meet up with my mother and get a hug. There was no safe touch in prison, no touch at all. He hadn't had a hug in months. So the next week, death row coming out. Put on the shackles on his wrist, on his ankle, put on the belly chain, and he started walking. And this time, he tried to speed up the guard a little bit. He moved as fast as he could. He went around the corner. He was listening to the chains, and he was listening to something else, and he heard it. He heard his mother's footsteps coming down that hallway. He hurried up, and then there he was, right there in the hallway, and there was his mama, right there in front of him. And he stopped and looked at the guards and said, "Please, could I get a hug?" Well, the guards looked at him, looked at each other. That was entirely against the rules, but what the hey? Sure, go ahead, get a hug. And Kenny leaned forward. His arms shackled, his feet shackled. He leaned into his mother's arms and felt her hold him. He could smell her hairspray and feel her cheek on his, and he nestled his face against hers. And then they separated. And he went his way and she went her way. But he had that hug. And after visiting hours were over and he got back in his cell and the bars closed, he lay down on his little bed and relived that hug in slow motion. The smell, the feel, the sense of her, and it filled him with warmth. No one could take that away from him. Because of an error in the trial, after spending 5 years on death row, he was commuted to life in prison. And after serving 15 years of his life sentence, he finally came up for parole. In that time, he has taught himself to be a gifted artist, painter, a potter, a carver and sculptor of leather. He's been commissioned by Fort Sill to do paintings. He's had his artwork bought by a number of important collections. And he went up for parole, and the first year he was turned down. And so the second year he went up for parole, and he had 35 letters. People who supported him and said, "Yes, we think he should be out," and he was turned down. And the third year he came up for parole, he had 55 letters. He had a place to stay with his sister. He had a job lined up. He had an offer of graduate school in art at the University of Oklahoma. He had a lot of support. And when the 5 parole board members voted, it was 3 yes, 2 no. Kenny was eligible for what they call pre-parole. All the paperwork had to be filed at the right time, and all the arrangements made, and the place where he would stay, and the parole officer, and the parole officer visited the house and did all this kind of checking. All the procedures were met, all the bureaucratic steps gone through. Then there was a new governor elected. And one of his platforms was no parole for murderers, law and order. And when he found out that this convicted murderer was going to be released. He found an administrative reason to rescind the parole. 8 days before Kenny was to leave. He had already packed up all his things. He'd shipped his books home. They already had a telephone installed. Everything was ready. He'd followed all the rules. And so, this coming January will be 1 year that Kenny is still in prison. The plans are to go to the federal courts in hopes of securing release. He is 37 years old. He spent more than half his life in prison. That is all. Okay. One more story, a funny one, and then we'll open it up for open mic. There was a young boy who wanted more than anything to have a bicycle. All his friends had bicycles. All his relatives and cousins had bicycles. So he went to his mom and said, "Mom, I want a bicycle really bad. Can I please have it?" And she says, "You know we can't afford a bicycle. Go see your father." So he goes to his father and says, "Papa, I really want a bicycle. All the neighbor kids have one, and all our cousins have one. I really want one. Please, can I have a bicycle?" "Look," he says, "you know we can't afford it this year. I'm awfully sorry, but if you want a bicycle, you better go ask God." So he goes up to his room and he gets out a sheet of paper. "Dear God, I want a bicycle so bad." He balls it up and throws it away. Gets out another sheet. "Dear God, I deserve a bicycle because..." So he balls that one up and throws it away. Takes out another sheet. "Dear God, please give me a bicycle because all the other kids have one." It up, throws it away. He goes downstairs to where in the living room, a good Catholic family here, they have a statue of the Virgin standing there with her hands showering grace on the world. And he looks at that statue, picks it up, and he takes it upstairs where he wraps it very carefully in a towel, which he then puts in his bottom dresser drawer. "Dear God, if you want to see your mama again..." Thank you all for being such a good audience. And now I'd like to open it up for open mic. If there's anyone who would like to share a story. Michael, yes, do come.
First off, I have to apologize because I write stories. I'm ready to tell one. And first, I need to warm up with one. And I'm a pastor in a small town about 20 miles right over Buckskin Mountain, a town called Levmore. And our church was built in 1906, and it has a belfry. We ring the bell every Sunday morning, a rarity in churches these days, and it's a manual bell. And when I first got there, I needed to have someone to ring the bell for me because I was busy doing other things before worship. And I put an advertisement in the church newsletter. And the first Sunday morning, no one was there to ring the bell. So I put an advertisement in the city newspaper, the Echo, and I had one applicant. It was this little boy, about this tall. It was a big bell. And he comes in, he says, "Pastor, I hear the bells, and I would like to play the bell for you." I said, "Well, I don't think you can quite do it." But he was hopeful. He said, "I can ring the bell, Pastor. I know I can." So we climbed the ladder up to where the bell is, and he walked around it, this big bell. And he looked at it, and suddenly he grabbed it with both hands and hit his face into the bell, and it rang. And he grabbed his face and fell out of the belfry. I haven't been there very long. I can see the headline. So I climbed down the ladder to this child laying on the ground below. He wasn't dead, he was breathing. So I called 911 and I could hear the sirens going off in the distance as they come there. And I'm trying not to move him too much. And one of the paramedics comes up to me and says, "Pastor, what's this child's name?" "I don't know his name," I said, "but his face rings a bell." The next day, another little boy, smaller, arrives at my office and says, "Pastor, my brother was the one who rang your bell. And I promised him at the hospital when I saw him last night that I would take his place and do a good job." It was hard for me to say no to him, but I did. But he begged and begged and followed me around all day long until at last I gave him a chance and took him up to the belfry and tried to block the hole where his brother had gone through. And sure enough, this child grabbed the bell in his hands and banged his head against it and went off the other side and hit the sidewalk. When I called the paramedics, they didn't laugh. And they showed up and asked me once again, "What's the boy's name? We have to call his parents." This time it was fatal. I said, "I don't know his name, but he's a dead ringer for his brother." Okay. Running is supposed to be healthy. This next one, I had to have a little levity, a little sick humor levity in there after I ever wanted to see your mother again. But I'd like to tell you the story about Henry. In 1968, I was a small boy, relatively small, preteen, 10, 11-year-old, and we had a gang in which we ran in, about a dozen boys. One of our favorite things was to go down to the river, which was verboten, and my mother even said it that way, just verboten. The river is the Spokane, which claims 2, sometimes 3 lives a year. And it's green, sometimes angry waters. They're cold and they're rocky beneath, and we defied that order every chance we got. And the 12 of us would take our BB guns down to the river and pump them up. And in the middle of August, wearing winter coats and ski masks, shoot each other until we'd beg for mercy. There are scars on my arms from our games doing this. In that neighborhood, there was a boy named Henry. And Henry was dull. Not just that he was slow of wit, although he was that, or slow of foot because he was that too, but even his clothing and his coloring were dull. His hair yellow, his skin slightly jaundiced. He moved with that awkward gait of tired cattle being herded, thumping as he walked, and no one liked Henry. When his mother called him to their little green wooden house, she would scream out the window, "Henry!" And all the boys in the neighborhood would shout, "Coming, mother!" We could outrun Henry, and we needed to from time to time. Behind fences and shrubs and hedges, we would wait for him in autumn with the produce rotting and tired. Four of us, making sure we had a clear crossfire, would catch him in the alleys and sidewalks. Sometimes he would catch us and we'd take a drumming for it, but always the 12 of us would find ways to torment him. Maybe we deserved his wrath. Maybe we earned it. But we always knew it was coming when we saw Henry. And so we avoided him. And yet Henry always stayed on the periphery of our group. Wherever we went, Henry was there. Slowly, methodically, following after us. Outside the group of 12 was another boy whose name I never knew except we called him Gator. He was everything Henry was not. Henry was tall and Gator was short. Henry was slow and Gator was quick, and tongue and hand and foot, the fastest, fleetest of us all. And it was his wit, I think, that kept him out of our group. We loathed him. But because he was fast, we couldn't outrun him. Because he was quick of mind, we couldn't outwit him. And so he was always there. The 13th at the table, the 13th in our group, following along, eager to please like a puppy, he waggled behind us. The one redeeming quality of Gator was that he could torment Henry better than anyone because he was faster and quicker. And so Henry hated him most of all the boys. We could see Gator at times dancing around on picnic tables at the park, jumping behind trees, behind the fireplace of stone, throwing taunts like we threw tomatoes and peaches. And Henry lumbering, slow, trying to catch him, never, ever making it. It was a fairly late spring day when the river runoff was at its peak, when we went down to the river and Gator tagged along behind us. And we were playing right on its banks, jumping from log to log, trying to catch minnows and tadpoles. Sometimes we'd slip in the shallow areas and we'd strip down our clothes and hang them on the rocks to dry, ducking behind trees when cars would go by on the road just above us. I remember one time doing that and going home and yelling through the house, "Mom, we're going to have a water fight," and turning on the hoses and hosing each other down, trying to take away the evidence. But this day we were content enough just to be together in the sunshine with the river yelling beside us. And Gator laughing and trying so hard to become part of the group, and we trying even harder to ignore him. We did not see the slow shadow stalking down on us of Henry until he was right there, Our first instinct was to run. But Gator's voice stopped us. He laughed and taunted Henry and started jumping between the logs that clogged the river. From log to log he jumped, throwing insult after perfect insult. And we turned and watched that pallid, tall specter of a boy shaking with rage. And we thought we'd watch the show. Henry tried. Gator leapt and dashed and darted and flitted like a dragonfly across the river he moved. But even the quickest foot misses sometimes, and Gator missed. And with not even a splash, he went down. Down into that green, dark, cold, swirling monster of a river. And all of us gasped. We knew we were not supposed to be there. We would not run for an adult, because to do that would be to confess our guilt. And so we looked at the empty place where Gator had just gone down, frozen in fear and indecision. And no one moved but Henry. Henry lumbered out across the logs till he found the place where Gator had gone under. And he reached down that long, lanky arm and brought up nothing. And so he dove in and disappeared behind his archest enemy. And a moment later, a sputtering, coughing, curly head came up, and it was Gator, pulling himself up, pulling himself out of the place where Henry had disappeared. Relief unthawed our limbs, and we reached out and pulled him up and patted him on the back and laughed, nervous, joyful laughs. I don't know who was the first to notice that no one followed Gator out of that water. 3 days later, his wrinkled body washed up on shore downstream. Henry's life for Gator's. And the only thought in our heads, in our hearts, that day was that while we were still enemies, Christ gave up his life for us. While we were still enemies.